And I got out, I come running back to you. I come running back to you. Yeah, I come running back to you.
Welcome to the Wayne Bennett Podcast, celebrating West Virginia's people, places, and the culture of Southern Appalachia. Now here's your host, Wayne Bennett.
Welcome to Wayne Bennett's podcast. My name is Wayne Bennett, and this is episode 100. It's April the 21st, 2023. Our intro song, we have a new one, and it's by Alabaster Boxer, and they have a new album out called Currency of Dreams. There's 10 songs on it. Front man is Nick Durham. So the other guys, Jason Lockhart, Brian Bell, Drew Lawrence, Robbie Landham, Randy Gilkey, and I may have left somebody's name out, but Nick's supposed to be on here in a couple of weeks, so we'll, and they're kind of an American pop, bluegrass, rock fusion band, and they're really talented. If you get a chance to listen to these guys or chances to listen to Currency of Dreams. The song, our intro song, is called West Virginia Heat, and good shout out to those guys. And our guest today is an actor, a comedian, playwright, theatrical director, and sometimes titled West Virginia's favorite son, Nick Urich. Welcome, Nick.
Hey, good to see you, Wayne.
Hey, first of all, what's a nationality? What nationality is the name Urich?
So it actually is a Slavic. I believe it was my great-great-grandfather's family were the first ones to come over from the old country, so to speak, around about a little bit before World War One, I believe. And, of course, coming through Ellis Island in those days, they reworked a lot of those more ethnic sounding names, and I believe at one point it was Yurko, then Yurzefik or something, and I think, yeah, Urich was the Americanized version of one of those, and obviously they didn't Americanize it that well, because telemarketers still pronounce it every different way, and that's some of our childhood sports trophies. I think my brother Sam had a baseball trophy where it was written as Uriak. And I got a history award in elementary school where they left off the Y. And so, I guess they tried at Ellis Island. But
Well, speaking of elementary school, the first time that I ever got acquainted with you, that you didn't know it, but I saw a picture of a young Nick Urich in the first grade in the newspaper, and you had your hands over your eyes like you're looking through a binoculars and squatted down and you're watching the sixth grade show. And I said to somebody, I said, we're going to have him in school here in a few years. And I didn't even know you or anything. And then later I saw the name that you were in the spelling bee, like in the sixth grade. And I said, and then I was teaching at Park Junior High, and then all of a sudden there you are. And
I was going to say, you had my brother around then too in class, but yeah.
And I had Sam in class, and while you were at Park, you and I had, you were on the newspaper staff, which a lot of people don't realize. We had a pretty good newspaper for a junior high. I mean, it was pretty
we really ramped it up there that year especially. And what, it's crazy too, that's everyone asks, where were you on 9/11? It was in your class that day. And I feel like just the magnitude of history that we were experiencing at that time too kind of made us all take what journalism we were doing a little more seriously.
There was a fellow student, Drew Newton, I think. You and Drew pretty much ran the newspaper yourself. And
Jacob Lane and Stephen Word were two more in that group, too, that got to give a lot of credit. But, yeah.
Yeah, we had some good writers on that crew, and I don't even think I'm not even sure they even have a newspaper now.
But. Yeah, I don't know. Trying to think. Well, I went over there last summer to pick up some stuff from their theater department, so I know they still have that. But yeah, I don't know. Well, too. I mean, it only goes up to eighth grade now, so
yeah.
I think it did make a difference having some of us that were just a little bit older back then.
Now you you wrestled also. You were kind of in a green uniform, and you were tall and thin for that particular weight class. Kind of looked like a green bean in a way.
Well, that's, yeah. I remember I was like the last year I wrestled, I was 5'10" and 92 pounds, and
had a lot of leverage.
Well, yeah. Like, I mean, everyone I'd go up against, I mean, sometimes there'd be those guys that were just built like, you know, little missiles that could, you know, just knock me down like nothing. But then there are those guys that, you know, if I got to where I could, that's what I think. I just got better at using my height advantage toward the end there, because, well, there was that one guy from Independence, though, Richard Rash, I think was his name. Yeah, I remember wrestling him in the county championship, and that's one guy I never, ever could beat.
Yeah, he turned out to be a pretty good high school wrestler, too.
Yeah, I saw his name in the paper many, many years after that. But, yeah, that last match, I was like, well, I'm at least not going to let him pin me.
So. But you actually had a good, pretty good year, your last year. You're pretty productive. And we got to tell about one of the trips, though, when we came back from Greenbrier East, when we got off the bus.
Yeah, that was my 14th birthday, too.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, I thought it was cool, you know, yeah, wrestling on my birthday sounds fun, but we get back and the bus parks right in front of Park Junior High, and my mom's parked across the street to pick me up, and, yeah, I remember a nice lady, one of the other wrestling moms, had stopped to let me cross, but guy behind her was not so patient, whipped right around and hit me with his car.
Well, they had... And the bus had all the lights on. I mean, it was stopped, you know.
Well, I think it was like a 16-year-old kid, too, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was, I looked and I saw a big green clump laying in the road. And I actually thought you might have been dead. And
I thought I was. Like, man, that was one of those life flashes before your eyes moments, too. Like,
and it was cold. It was kind of snowy like. And there you are. And of course, we called an ambulance. And what injuries did you actually end up with?
Well, luckily I didn't break anything. I mean, I was concussed, of course, but yeah, I mean, it was no worse than really a sprain in my ankle and left a bad bruise on my knee. I mean, I was on crutches a couple weeks. Of course, that was Christmas break, so by the time I came back to school, they had me using a cane, which that felt very cool at the time, actually.
Your brother Sam, I had him in school, and then we'll talk a little bit about him. And Alice, she ran cross country for me later, as you did, and she's well adept in teaching art and different things like that. But your dad and mom, your mother was Barbie Hopkins or Barbara Hopkins from the, and your dad was John Uring, and remarkable people. I mean, they. Very talented people. They were excellent teachers. And I kind of like the way they handled you kids. They put you in different disciplines and let you experience this and that. And they were very supportive. Almost always you saw one of them at, you know, three kids will keep you busy. And, almost always one of your parents was at your games or shows or whatever. And your dad was a valedictorian at his high school. He went to the University of Pitt. He was a tremendous
hopefully artist. No Mountaineers will hold that against him, but yeah. It's actually a good friend of ours used to say that my dad was the one Pitt man he ever respected.
and he was outspoken enough. He was a Vietnam War protester. He definitely, like you, believed in the freedom of speech, regardless of what you thought. You know, you had the right to say it. I had a chance to work with your mother a couple of times, but very impressive people. How do you think they kept up? I know you're...
Well, it's something that, you know, me and my brother talk about to this day, like just reflecting on. I mean, both of them being self-employed, they really tried to make their work life in such a way that, yeah, one of them could always be at whatever they were doing. And yeah, the attitude was always, hey, there's this thing coming up. Why don't you try it out? So, yeah, it was never really a thing of like, you know, that's what we did realize, that not everyone did theater and sports and, you know, music and whatever else, art. Like, I mean, looking back at, you know, we had friends that, wow, they were a sports family and that was great. Or, yeah, they were a theater family and that's all they did. But, I mean, obviously we found the things we were better at than others. But, I mean, having an appreciation for, you know, all skill levels of all professions. And I think, I mean, a lot of that came too from how both my parents were raised. Like, just the environment was always eclectic. My dad's family in particular, I mean, both of his parents were very involved in their community up in Pennsylvania and on very different sides of the political aisle too, which meant something different back then.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, my dad's father was, you know, he was a second or third generation immigrant coal miner from eastern Pennsylvania who, you know, went on to be a doctor. And, you know, his mom, though, was, you know, old money, western Pennsylvania and, you know, old money conservative. But that might have kind of played into why my dad was so outspoken, too, because, I mean, in his family, you know, dinner table discussions were always, you know, people with different views who understood each other. And
did your parents ever have to punish you guys? I mean,
yeah.
What did they use? What form of punishment did they use?
Well, you know, I mean, the old grounding and being sent to our room usually work to some degree, but, you know, as we became more and more creative in our pursuits, you know, that became less of a punishment. So,
absolutely.
I don't know. I mean, I think that by the time we got older, the worst punishment was a long, drawn-out conversation about whatever we had done.
I see.
It's like, yeah, we know we can't send you to your rooms because you're just gonna, you know, listen to music or play guitar or draw or write up there, which good, but it's not a punishment. So I think that, yeah, after a while it's like, well, gosh, if I screw up now, it's going to be an hour out of my day or more.
And when you got to Woodrow, Wilson, you ran cross country, when I was coaching there, and you actually were developing a pretty good cross country runner, and your sister Alice did too, and you were part of the Governor's Academy, Honor Academy. Yeah. Were you involved? How old were you when you got involved in the theater on stage?
Well, I mean, it was definitely a presence my whole life. I mean, furthest thing back I remember is just being a wise man at a Christmas pageant at church. So, I mean, it's always been an interest, but I feel like I didn't start to think of it as possibly a professional pursuit until sometime in junior high when, you know, I started to do more plays there at school and, you know, taking more classes at Theater West Virginia and, yeah, I did more stuff at the Princess Playhouse in Mount Hope with Michael Martin, who I'm still working with on different stuff now. But yeah, I think just that's when I started to spend a lot more time on stage and I realized, like, you know, I want to make a living doing some form of this. And of course, the making a living part comes and goes. And I've kind of realized that, you know, beyond acting, like, you know, you're kind of running through my whole resume at the beginning. It's like, yeah, kind of in college is when I learned that, oh, if you want this to be your life, you got to know how to do a little bit of everything.
Yeah. What kind of music did you listen to in high school? I mean, was
it- High school was kind of, you know, when I hit my like punk/emo phase probably, but you know, there's always a love of like, you know, like 60s through 80s rock. And of course, now I've kind of gone through a rebirth of like 90s alternative rock. Like, I mean, REM's always been one of my favorite bands ever. And that's like the one that kind of, you know, spanned all areas of interest. But lately I've kind of, I don't know, folk music has always been a love of mine too. And I think as I've been working on this, you know, upcoming project about this folk singer, I've realized that's part of why I liked punk so much, too, is because there is a very basic approach that both genres have.
You went to WVU after high school, right?
Yeah, for most of my college career. I also spent 3 semesters at USC.
Yeah.
But L.A. was a lot for me back then, so, yeah.
But now, you ended up in Cleveland, and they, you know, things that come to my mind with Cleveland, the brouhaha stage, the playboy of the Western world, the verbosity in Appalachia, the sad boys social club, you mentioned maybe Poverty Walker Project. Radio Free Uric. That's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, a lot's been happening the last 10 years that I was in Cleveland, and some of that's been able to carry over since I moved back, too. Brouhaha Stage, that was actually one of my last comedy festivals I did in Morgantown. But yeah, Sad Boys Social Club, that was the sketch comedy group that I worked with up there for 5 years. And yeah, I mean, during that time, we got to travel quite a bit, too. They actually came down one of the summers I was working at Theater West Virginia in 2017. They came down and did a show at the Raleigh Playhouse with me. And we brought in another comic from Charleston to do a guest spot. And so, yeah, I also got to perform in Michigan a lot with them, too. So that's something that really, I think, expanded my skill set, too. And yeah, like a couple of guys from that group, like, you know, I still stay in touch with. And, you know, we've kind of parted ways since I've left, but they're kind of working on, well, I don't know how public they want to make it, but they've got something exciting coming up.
One of the things that I read about, you said you hated the term world famous.
Yeah, that was actually on the podcast, Let the Hate Flow Through You, that my friend Jeremy Shear and Jordan Patrick were doing up there. And yeah, it was just every week they'd have a different comic on, or, you know, even just someone who wasn't a comic to just talk about a random topic they hated. And yeah, I went on with the phrase world famous because it's like, because it's such hyperbole. Like, at the time, what brought it up was there's these radio ads I kept hearing around Cleveland for these car dealerships on the world famous Bedford Auto Mile outside of town. And it's like, really? They're talking about the Bedford Auto Mile in Japan or South Africa? I don't think so.
But one of the things, a quote from you on your comedy, it says, "I just hope people will come with an open mind and leave the show seeing the best in themselves and the best in other people, even if they don't always agree with them." And that's a pretty good philosophy, you know, as far as that. I hope you accomplish that.
Not always. I'm glad that you brought that up because, you know, sometimes, you know, it's not always that easy, but that is always the goal, too.
Why Cleveland? How'd you end up in Cleveland?
Well, I had been living back here for about a year after I finished college. And that summer of 2011, you know, I met a girl who was going to school up there and also met a friend that hooked me up with a job opportunity at Cedar Point. So it was kind of like, hey, I've got money, I've got people, I've got potential work, so let's try it out. And yeah, like I ended up getting good momentum going on just, you know, different performing work up there, and you know, made good connections with people in the comedy scene, and yeah, like before I knew it, I had a good support system going, and just a situation where I could kind of still travel freely back here for different things I was doing. So yeah, I mean, as far as, you know, cities that are within a day's drive, it's a really good place for anyone to set up.
I've got a nephew who lives in Cleveland and loves it there. I like the theater. We go to Barter Theater in Abingdon, Virginia, several times. Charleston, we'll take in a play there occasionally.
Another of my teacher friends, Neil Lacey, was just posting about going to Barter Theater.
Yeah, we've been there several of their shows there. In Fayette County, of course, and the Raleigh Playhouse as often as we can. When you've been involved with Theater West Virginia 17, 18 years, haven't you, or longer?
That's my first official job there, was serving concessions in the summer of 2004. So, and then I started acting in 2006. So, yeah, this will make 17 years that I've been involved on the artistic side of things.
So you were too young. You never met Billy Ed Wheeler or Benjamin or Yul
Brynner? Oh, John Benjamin, actually. Yeah, I got to work with him. He was one of those guys that anytime, I grew up with him as one of my family's, you know, good theater friends, that anytime he was in town for the summer, you know, we'd always, it was a big deal getting together with him. So, yeah, I got to work with him, let's see, he passed in 2010, so the last few years of his life, I actually got to work with him. Yul Brynner, I only got to know by reputation. Yeah, he passed in 2002 before I was really involved, but I got to hear some great stories about him, definitely.
And I don't know, the guy who actually wrote Honey and the Rock, Kermit Hunter, I don't know that I've ever met him or even saw him.
He passed in 2001, so actually a good friend of mine, Susie Sayre, who's actually come back as our costumer the last couple of summers. She's a relative of Kermit Hunter's, which I think is very cool that someone related to the original playwright is now working with us. But and Billy Ed Wheeler, I feel like my first few years he'd come every summer, so I think I did get to meet him in passing, but I was probably one of a million actors, you know, that day. Like, oh, thank you for your great work. It's an honor to do your production. And, you know, stuff that he probably hears, over and over again.
The thing I've noticed, of course, you've played so many different roles at Theater West Virginia. I mean, Honey and the Rock, Hatfields, McCoys, Rocket Boys, Wizard of Oz, Alice in Wonderland. What are some of the roles that you've played and positions that you've held in Theater West Virginia in the past 17 years?
Oh, well, as far as roles that I've played, one of my favorites was Whitey Hawkins in Honey and the Rock. That's, you know, the crazy old man that's always, you know, mucking everything up, but then has words of wisdom at the end. And I don't know, from the time I first saw that show when I was 7 years old, old friend Andy Woodruff was playing the role back then, and actually when I directed it back in 2021, I brought him back to that role, so it kind of came full circle that, you know, he's the one that inspired me to do that role, and, you know, I played it for a few years, then I got to direct, you know, the guy that was my biggest influence. So, yeah, that's a role that holds a lot of special meaning. And now, Hatfields and McCoys, though, I think that this summer will make 8 different characters I've played in that one.
Wow.
Yeah, this year I'll be playing Tolbert McCoy, which is, that's a much more intense character than I've played. You know, because for a long time it was, you know, more comedic or character roles. You know, Famer McCoy was the, kind of more comedic brother that I played in that show, and don't know. I mean, this
has been the artistic director also.
Yeah. I was artistic director through, let's see, 2019 through 21. And then I was co-artistic and technical director last year. And then I was away for a while. And now I'm back as an actor.
What does an artistic director do?
I mean, that's basically the person who kind of, helps set the season, helps hire the company. And
okay.
Yeah, it's a very big job. That's why we started splitting it between two people for a while.
Of course, Scott Hill has resigned or retired, and the poor guy had to work through the pandemic. He had to work through one season that it rained every day, I think. I've heard Scott talk several times, and he was great guy, easy guy to deal with, and kind of kept things going, in my opinion. But it would be, you have an outside agenda there. I mean, it's tough when you got to fight the weather and a lot, all the other things. I mean, one time Honey and the Rock had a matinee, a Sunday afternoon show, I think back in the early days for a short period of time. You think that'll ever return?
You know, I don't really know. An idea that has been thrown about years ago, that it was another thing that, we'd started talking about, but then the pandemic just, threw to the winds pretty much. But I've always liked the idea of, doing kind of shorter, small cast one acts as matinees in that big space up at the top of the house there. Kind of like setting up a black box, because the thing is, I mean, it's hotter and hotter every summer. So, because the times we've discussed matinees back out there over the years, the main thing is, gosh, people are going to sweat to death in those seats. And, I mean, as we've had hotter summers too, I mean, it's been to the point where we really try, not to rehearse on stage, during the middle part of the day if we can help it. So yeah. That's, and I don't know, like, things are kind of, this is very much a rebuilding year. Gail Oakes, who's the new GM, I've had some great talks with too. And I mean, there's a lot of enthusiasm this year, I think, about kind of, all banding together. And it's very much about quality over quantity this year. Like, I mean, as much as satisfying as it was in some ways to pull off four productions a couple years ago, doing only two really, really good ones is, I think it's going to put a lot of positive energy back into the company.
I kind of noticed that it seemed like and it may just be me, but it seemed like the cast has gotten younger and younger. I mean, I used to be, I remember a lot of the characters were, they were old, they were old enough to play that particular part. And but now a lot of times the cast, the actors are getting driven to practice and stuff by their parents because they're not old enough to have a driver's license. I mean, it just seemed like they're younger and younger.
Well, and that's a hard thing really throughout the professional theater world lately is, I mean, yeah, a lot of the people who are able to do this kind of work are, people who are either young enough, they have parental support, or, people who are older and retired. So there's just fewer and fewer professional actors, around my age, like 30s, 40s, 50s, because, it's just a harder and harder line of work to make a living in. So at the same time, I feel like there is going to be a return to just the gig economy is really what's helped me and a lot of people around my age group and older continue to take professional acting jobs, even if, the pay's not what we would hope it would be. Because, well, I mean, part of the message to the listeners here, too, is, support your local theater, because, I mean, we're there because we love it.
Have you ever been married or had a family or?
Nope. And come close a couple of times, but There's a reason, too. A lot of actors my age are still single because it is hard to kind of get the stability in that line of work. Like, actually, a while back, I met up with some old friends from, elementary school, I think, at Flat Top Lake. And, yeah, one of them's expected their first kid. And, I made some sarcastic joke about, boy, I'm so glad you're about to be responsible for a child. He's like, more responsible than you'd ever be. I was like, you've kind of had a quote-unquote real job the last 15 years, and I've been kind of a wandering troubadour on some level, so
How does a person get on Broadway? How does a person get into the little bigger time, I guess, more paying job? I saw where the Phantom of the Opera is shutting down after 35 years or something, but how do you get there?
Well, I mean, a lot of it is the people who are willing to take that gamble and bet on themselves. I mean, because moving to New York or LA is a huge gamble. I mean, it's expensive and there's no guarantee that anything good's going to happen there. Matter of fact, the more likelihood is, bad's going to happen there. But the people I know who have made it work are, the kind of people that just, you have to basically, you got to be able to run your own business. And that's kind of, something I'm learning late in the game. You mentioned Radio Free Productions. That's just now something that I've started pursuing as far as, making myself my own business. And, that's kind of been part of the whole refocusing of energy since I moved back here. So, yeah, the people who make it work in New York and L.A. are really the ones who come the most prepared. Uh-huh. And that is, something I kind of know about myself, too, that, that's kind of what made me realize I needed to move back from L.A. And, New York is great to visit and perform in if you can, but, yeah, it's really the people that set out with a business mindset of how they're going to, make every aspect of it work. And, that still is no guarantee of getting discovered, but it does definitely set you up to take care of yourself while you look for other opportunities.
Yeah. Another quote from Nick Yurick. I just want to make cool things with cool people that I like and maybe not starve. And how did you keep from starving during the COVID? I mean, how did you make it?
Well, I mean, I don't want to say I was one of the lucky few, but I mean, during COVID, I was working a part-time office job at Playhouse Square up in Cleveland. It's actually the largest performing arts center outside New York, and so they had the money to keep us on payroll during that time.
Oh, wow.
And, I still had a staff position at TWV that they, paid me to make the radio drama of Hatfields and McCoys during that time and, other remote projects. So, I didn't have as much work as I did, pre-pandemic, but I had, a couple steady things going at least. And, in the meantime, that's really where Sad Boys Social Club amped up a lot of things, because we kind of realized that, hey, we all have the ability to film our own scenes of, these different things in our own homes. So that's when we started, doing these half-hour web specials, because up till then, we do some short videos here and there, but we mostly just performed live, and all of a sudden not being able to perform live meant that, okay, so how do we create content when we can't be in the same room? And so, through the magic of green screen and Zoom and webcams, we managed to put together a couple half-hour specials with either little to no, contact between each other.
Now, your brother, Sam, he's had some training in video production or something?
Yeah, he actually, his degree was in screenwriting and film from USC. So,
you've come back to Beckley. You were 10 years in Cleveland. Now you've moved back. And I got to see you at the West Virginia Collective at the Playhouse in Beckley, and you and was Tobias Sears?
Tobias
Sears. You guys were in the one-act play, The Zoo, and there were three of them, three one-act plays that were really good. I mean, they were all very different. Yours was more dramatic, was definitely the more dramatic type. And you guys did a great job, man. I mean, and Tobias, I wasn't really familiar with him. I knew you could do a good job, yeah. But I wasn't. He did a real good job. And we try to go to about everything we can at the Playhouse, and hope you stay involved with the West Virginia.
Oh, yeah. Collective.
Those guys are talented people. You know, Jason Lockhart and that bunch are Robbie Moore, and I mean, really good. What's your plans? I mean, what's your plans in the next 10 years? What do you look to be doing?
Well, kind of the biggest endeavor I have personally that I hope is going to take off is it's going to be a film production company I'm starting up right now. And the current project is the Poverty Walker Project, which I mentioned earlier. And that's a story of a fictional folk singer from Mount Hope that kind of gets whisked away on a bizarre rock and roll journey in the late 70s that kind of takes him throughout the last 40 years of rock history, from, you know, punk to grunge to, you know, the rap scene in Detroit. And right now what we're doing is a couple of basically proof of concept shorts that kind of, you know, showcase the character and what it's all about and the style of humor. And sorry, anytime I get going on this, you know, there's so many aspects to it. But sort of the goal right now is we're trying to set up a Patreon within the next month or so, which that's an online platform where people can, you know, pay a couple bucks to subscribe to your content. So kind of, we're going to be doing YouTube shorts that, you know, anyone can see, and eventually we'll have full-length webisodes for the Patreon subscribers. And the goal at the end of the summer is to start a Kickstarter to crowdfund a feature-length film. So,
that's cool.
Yeah, like there's a couple of different business models that have kind of emerged just in recent years I'm trying to follow. For example, there's a Canadian comedy show called Letterkenny that's on Hulu, and they kind of started out as just doing YouTube shorts and, you know, eventually got interest in doing a full-length series. And another one going way back 20 years ago is this cartoon site called Homestar Runner, and they funded themselves mostly by merch sales. So, you know, once the web series is up, you know, there'll be... It's having a fake musician is an easy way to sell merch, too. And
I do want to mention, we go back a minute and talk about Theater West Virginia. Stephen P. New has been a big supporter of that. You've got an office, and I don't know what do you have on North Canal there? I mean, it was Stephen that's helped set up.
The old Learning Tree building, that's our rehearsal space now, and actors' housing. And yeah, he owns another building that we house actors at further up the street. And gosh, you know, it's probably more than that. I do know that pretty much any extra property he has for anything, you know.
Do actors come in and stay in any of his properties?
Yeah. We usually get a dozen or so actors from out of town that we house there right on site. And it's convenient because the ones in the apartments at the rehearsal space, I mean, they can roll out a bed and they're already at work.
Yeah, that's great. That is great. It takes a special person to be an entertainer and a talented, or you got to be smart, you got to be flexible. What advice would you give to a young person that's thinking about making acting a career?
Have no shame, but always have dignity, which is to say, there's nothing too silly, nothing too ridiculous to be a worthwhile performance outlet. But, you know, never sell your talent short either. And that's, I think that, I don't know, I feel like I always had all the confidence in the world going into this, but, you know, build your skill set early. I mean, that's the one thing that I maybe didn't have enough of and I'm just developing now is, you know, organizational skills. Uh-huh. And I mean, a lot of that stuff, you know, I learned on the fly, just, you know, having leadership positions, sort of being thrown into them over the years. But, you know, I would say if you're like a junior high school student, you know, that thinks, yeah, theater's what I want to do, learn every aspect of it early.
You're talking about dancing, singing, yeah. Music.
Yeah, dancing, singing, music, technical work, stage management work. I mean, I'll tell you, like, just in the last couple of years, I've been able to start getting work as a stage manager, which is really one of the hardest jobs in theater because that's kind of, you know, the, I guess, Rolodex / memory bank for a whole production. And again, you know, you talk about jobs that takes a special person to do. That's definitely one of them. And yeah, I would say learn management along with all this other stuff, because you are going to be your own small business someday.
One more quote, Nick Urich quote, time is a fact finite though, and it is only worth a damn if you're getting true joy out of what you do with it, because that is the fact why I chose this line of work. You're still enjoying it, right?
Yeah, more than ever, really, too. That was, you know, another reason to move back home for a while is just to, well, and that production with WV Collective, too, it's all about finding the joy again, because I've gotten to do a lot of amazing work the last 10 years, but, you know, it's a hustle to, you know, square one is always finding the joy again.
Well, I also see that you've kind of established a comedy. You're supposed to be at Jimmy's Place,
yep.
In May. This is April right now. So you're kind of establishing a little route of touching base on that. So hopefully you'll be successful. Well, Nick, I appreciate you coming by and talking to us. And we'll have to get you back in a 2 or 3 months after the season is getting winding down and see how things went. Hopefully it doesn't rain every day this year.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
And and give my best wishes to your family, and looking forward to seeing you in any of your future endeavors. Appreciate you, buddy.
Yeah, great seeing you again, Wayne. Thanks for having me.
Anybody else out there who would like to be on our podcast, you can contact me at awbennett50@gmail.com, and we would glad to have you. And until then, remember, if you're not dead yet, you're not done yet, and God bless you.
Dream. That was just a dream. That